Heretics, Chapter 20, Concluding Remarks on the Importance of Orthodoxy. Whether the human mind can advance or not is a question too little discussed, for nothing can be more dangerous than to found our social philosophy on any theory which is debatable but has not been debated. But if we assume, for the sake of argument, that there has been in the past or will be in the future such a thing as a growth or improvement of the human mind itself, there still remains a very sharp objection to be raised against the modern version of that improvement. The vice of the modern notion of mental progress is that it is always something concerned with the breaking of bonds, the effacing of boundaries, the casting away of dogmas. But if there be such a thing as mental growth, it must mean the growth into more and more definite convictions, into more and more dogmas. The human brain is a machine for coming to conclusions. If it cannot come to conclusions, it is rusty. When we hear of a man too clever to believe, we are hearing of something having almost the character of a contradiction in terms. It is like hearing of a nail that was too good to hold down a carpet, or a bolt that was too strong to keep a door shut. Man can hardly be defined, after the fashion of Carlyle, as an animal who makes tools. Ants and beavers and many other animals make tools, in the sense that they make an apparatus. Man can be defined as an animal that makes dogmas. As he piles doctrine on doctrine and conclusion on conclusion in the formation of some tremendous scheme of philosophy and religion, he is, in the only legitimate sense of which the expression is capable, becoming more and more human. When he drops one doctrine after another in a refined skepticism, when he declines to tie himself to a system, when he says that he has outgrown definitions, when he says that he disbelieves in finality, when, in his own imagination, he sits as God, holding no form of creed but contemplating all, then he is, by that very process, sinking slowly backwards into the vagueness of the vagrant animals and the unconsciousness of the grass. Trees have no dogmas. Turnips are singularly broad-minded. If, then, I repeat, there is to be mental advance, it must be mental advance in the construction of a definite philosophy of life. And that philosophy of life must be right and the other philosophies wrong. Now, of all or nearly all the able modern writers whom I have briefly studied in this book, this is especially and pleasingly true, that they do each of them have a constructive and affirmative view, and that they do take it seriously and ask us to take it seriously. There is nothing merely skeptically progressive about Mr. Rudyard Kipling. There is nothing in the least broad-minded about Mr. Bernard Shaw. The paganism of Mr. Lowes Dickinson is more grave than any Christianity. Even the opportunism of Mr. H.G. Wells is more dogmatic than the idealism of anybody else. Somebody complained, I think, to Matthew Arnold that he was getting as dogmatic as Carlyle. He replied, "That may be true, but you overlook an obvious difference. I am dogmatic and right, and Carlyle is dogmatic and wrong." The strong humor of the remark ought not to disguise us from its everlasting seriousness and common sense. No man ought to write at all, or even to speak at all, unless he thinks that he is in truth and the other man in error. In similar style, I hold that I am dogmatic and right, while Mr. Shaw is dogmatic and wrong. But my main point at present is to notice that the chief among these writers I have discussed do most sanely and courageously offer themselves as dogmatists, as founders of a system. It may be true that the thing in Mr. Shaw most interesting to me is the fact that Mr. Shaw is wrong. But it is equally true that the thing in Mr. Shaw most interesting to himself is the fact that Mr. Shaw is right. Mr. Shaw may have none with himself but himself. But it is not for himself he cares. It is for the vast and universal church, of which he is the only member. The two typical men of genius whom I have mentioned here, and with whose names I have begun this book, are very symbolic, if only because they have shown that the fiercest dogmatists can make the best artists. In the fin de siècle's atmosphere, everyone was crying out that literature should be free from all causes and all ethical creeds. Art was to produce only exquisite workmanship, and it was especially the note of those days to demand brilliant plays and brilliant short stories. And when they got them from a couple of moralists. The best short stories were written by a man trying to preach imperialism. The best plays were written by a man trying to preach socialism. All the art of all the artists looked tiny and tedious beside the art which was a byproduct of propaganda. The reason, indeed, is very simple. A man cannot be wise enough to be a great artist without being wise enough to wish to be a philosopher. A man cannot have the energy to produce good art without having the energy to wish to pass beyond it. A small artist is content with art. A great artist is content with nothing except everything. So we find that when real forces, good or bad, like Kipling and GBS, enter our arena, they bring with them not only startling and arresting art, but very startling and arresting dogmas. And they care even more, and desire us to care even more, about their startling and arresting dogmas than about their startling and arresting art. Mr. Shaw is a good dramatist, but what he desires more than anything else is to be a good politician. Mr. Rudyard Kipling is by divine caprice and natural genius an unconventional poet, but what he desires more than anything else is to be a conventional poet. He desires to be the poet of his people, bone of their bone, flesh of their flesh, understanding their origins, celebrating their destiny. He desires to be poet laureate, a most sensible and honorable and public-spirited desire. Having been given by the gods originality, that is, a disagreement with others, he desires divinely to agree with them. But the most striking instance of all, more striking, I think, even than either of these, is the instance of Mr. H.G. Wells. He began in a sort of insane infancy of pure art. He began by making a new heaven and a new earth, with the same irresponsible instinct by which men buy a new necktie or buttonhole. He began by trifling with the stars and systems in order to make ephemeral anecdotes. He killed the universe for a joke. He has since become more and more serious, and has become, as men inevitably do when they become more and more serious, more and more parochial. He was frivolous about the twilight of the gods, but he is serious about the London omnibus. He was careless in the time machine, for that dealt only with the destiny of all things. But he is careful and even cautious in Mankind in the Making, for that deals with the day after tomorrow. He began with the end of the world, and that was easy. Now he has gone on to the beginning of the world, and that is difficult. But the main result of all this is the same as in the other cases. The men who have really been the bold artists, the realistic artists, the uncompromising artists, are the men who have turned out, after all, to be writing with a purpose. Suppose that any cool and cynical art critic, any art critic fully impressed with the conviction that artists were greatest when they were most purely artistic, suppose that a man who professed ably a humane asceticism, as did Mr. Max Beerbohm, or a cruel asceticism, as did Mr. W. E. Henley, had cast his eye over the whole fictional literature, which was recent in the year 1895, and had been asked to select the three most vigorous and promising and original artist and artistic works, he would, I think, most certainly have said that for a fine artistic audacity, for a real artistic delicacy, or for a whiff of true novelty in art, the things that stood first were Soldiers Three by a Mr. Rudyard Kipling, Arms and the Man by a Mr. Bernard Shaw, and The Time Machine by a man called Wells. And all these men have shown themselves ingrainedly didactic. You may express the matter, if you will, by saying that if we want doctrines, we go to the great artists. But it is clear from the psychology of the matter that this is not the true statement. The true statement is that when we want any art tolerably brisk and bold, we have to go to the doctrinaires. In concluding this book, therefore, I would ask, first and foremost, that men such as these of whom I have spoken should not be insulted by being taken for artists. No man has any right whatever merely to enjoy the work of Mr. Bernard Shaw. He might as well enjoy the invasion of his country by the French. Mr. Shaw writes either to convince or to enrage us. No man has any business to be a Kiplingite without being a politician and an imperialist politician. If a man is first with us, it should be because of what is first with him. If a man convinces us at all, it should be by his convictions. If we hate a poem of Kipling's from political passion, We are hating it for the same reason that the poet loved it. If we dislike him because of his opinions, we are disliking him for the best of all possible reasons. If a man comes into Hyde Park to preach, it is permissible to hoot him, but it is discourteous to applaud him as a performing bear. And an artist is only a performing bear compared with the meanest man who fancies he has anything to say. There is indeed one class of modern writers and thinkers who cannot altogether be overlooked in this question, though there is no space here for a lengthy account of them, which indeed, to confess the truth, would consist chiefly of abuse. I mean those who get over all these abysses and reconcile all these wars by talking about aspects of truth, by saying that the art of Kipling represents one aspect of the truth, and the art of William Watson another, the art of Mr. Bernard Shaw one aspect of the truth, and the art of Mr. Cunningham Graham another, the art of Mr. H.G. Wells one aspect, and the art of Mr. Coventry Patmore another. I will only say here that this seems to me an evasion which has not even had the sense to disguise itself ingeniously in words. If we talk of a certain thing being an aspect of truth, it is evident that we claim to know what is truth. Just as if we talk of the hind leg of a dog, we claim to know what is a dog. Unfortunately, the philosopher who talks about aspects of truth generally also asks, what is truth? Frequently, even he denies the existence of truth, or says it is inconceivable by the human intelligence. How then can he recognize its aspects? I should not like to be an artist who brought an architectural sketch to a builder, saying, this is the south aspect of Seaview Cottage. Seaview Cottage, of course, does not exist. I should not even like very much to have to explain, under such circumstances, that Seaview Cottage might exist, but was unthinkable by the human mind. Nor should I like any better to be the bungling and absurd metaphysician who professed to be able to see everywhere the aspects of a truth that is not there. Of course, it is perfectly obvious that there are truths in Kipling, that there are truths in Shaw or Wells, but the degree to which we can perceive them depends strictly upon how far we have a definite conception inside us of what is truth. It is ludicrous to suppose that the more skeptical we are, the more we see good in everything. It is clear that the more we are certain what good is, the more we shall see good in everything. I plead, then, that we should agree or disagree with these men. I plead that we should agree with them at least in having an abstract belief. But I know that there are current in the modern world many vague objections to having an abstract belief, and I feel that we shall not get any further until we have dealt with some of them. The first objection is easily stated.